We always hear the importance of taking advantage of our 401k and IRA accounts. The tax advantages and employer match are just too good to pass up on. But is this true for early retirees? If I'm planning on retiring in my 40s, should I be locking my money away in these accounts? How do I bridge the gap between early retirement and 59 and a half, the age at which I can withdraw from these accounts penalty-free? Well, the good news is that isn't 100% true. There are ways to withdraw from these retirement accounts without paying the 10% penalty. And some of these strategies are fairly simple. Sean Mullaney, president of Mullaney Financial and Tax and writer behind the informative blog FITaxGuy.com, is here to share how to do this. In this episode, we deep dive into a couple of the strategies that can ensure that you can access your money before 59 and a half. Sean also shares a tax-efficient strategy for which accounts you should withdraw from first. This is Sean's third appearance on the show. He also appeared on episode 39 and 40, where we discussed what you need to know about taxes in your 20s and the mechanics of an HSA. Every time Sean comes on the show, I learn something new. Through this conversation, he actually changed my mind about how I'm currently funding my Roth and traditional accounts. He's such a wealth of knowledge whenever it comes to tax code and tax planning. So if you want to learn from Sean, let's get into it. I hope you enjoy my conversation with FI Tax Guy, Sean Mullaney. You know those moments where you think, I wish I would have learned this in school? Those are the topics that we love to talk about. Join me each week as I interview experts sharing their strategies for solving problems that us young adults will face throughout our 20s and 30s. So what are you waiting for? And if you want new episodes about adulting advice every Monday, hit that follow button. Well, Sean, I'm excited to have you back on the podcast. We were actually just talking about you on the very last episode. So I was interviewing Jesse Kramer, and he was my first three-peat guest. He's been on the show three times. And I told him, you're about to hold that honor for about 2 weeks. And then Sean Mullaney's coming back on the show for his third appearance. So Sean, welcome back on the show.
Justin, thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. So to kind of set the context for this conversation, as somebody that's routinely talking personal finance with 20-somethings, what I hear very often, and especially once they start doing some of the math and thinking about early retirement, financial independence, they're like, holy cow, like I might be retiring in my 50s, some people in their 40s, even some people that I've been talking to are like, I might be able to do it sometime in my 30s. And routinely, that conversation is followed up with a question, which is, should I be prioritizing my taxable brokerage account versus my retirement accounts? Because they learn that your retirement accounts have this rule on them that you can't pull any money out of them without a 10% penalty until you're at least 59 and a half. And I think it's a really fair question. And I'm excited to have you on the show because there's some validity behind that, but there's also ways to get money out of those accounts, plus a whole lot else to think about. So for context of this conversation, that is what we're going to be working through. Some of the ways that you feel like if you fit this profile, how you might be pulling out money in this tax-efficient way, in this compliant-efficient way, and in an administratively efficient way. So are you excited for this one?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I think first and obvious is if I'm retiring, and let's just paint a general profile. We're not giving any individual tax advice right now, but to just give a little bit of a profile for this conversation, let's assume someone's in their late 20s, they're looking at retiring or hitting financial independence by 40. Maybe they are roughly have about $60,000 in expenses, which means the retirement number, their FI number, 25 times expenses, is $1.5 million. The very first step, and something people often look past, is existing income. I highly doubt someone is probably going to retire at 40. They're probably crushing it in their career. They're probably a high earner anyway, and just go sip pina coladas on the beach. Maybe they do that for a little while. But I'm guessing sometime throughout there, they're going to have part-time work, side hustles, real estate income, maybe business income. That's all stuff that can kind of come off the top of this, you know, essential $60,000 of income they need every single year. So is that kind of fair to say that that would probably be the very first step? Or should we be considering actually funneling that money into retirement accounts still?
So Justin, you raise a really interesting profile, right? It's somewhat extreme, right? If we're thinking, hey, at 40, we're going to retire. And I have an additional thought that we could talk about a little later on about what that person might want to do at 40 instead of a full-fledged retirement. One, if you're, you know, late 20s and you're thinking, like, I really want to retire at 40, a couple things are probably going to be true. One, if you just max out the 401k and, say, do a Roth IRA, backdoor Roth IRA, under today's rules, that's $30,000, $23,000 in the 401k, $7,000 in the Roth IRA. I seriously doubt you're going to get to your FI number, however you determine it. And let's just say you've determined $1.5 million. I seriously doubt you're going to be at $1.5 million at age 40. So that tells us we have to contribute more than just the maximums on our 401k and Roth IRA. But then, Justin, you brought up a great counterpoint, which is, boy, do I want to have money tied up in these deferred accounts and there's this 10% early withdrawal penalty? Well, a couple thoughts on that. One, I would argue that taxable accounts are your friend if you're thinking about retiring at age 40. So what I mean by that is you should definitely generate some investments that are not inside 401ks, Roth IRAs, these types of retirement accounts, so that you could take that money anytime penalty-free. You might have to pay a capital gains tax on it, but it probably won't even be that bad. We'll come to that later in the conversation. So I definitely think there's a case to build up a strong, you know, a solid amount of these taxable accounts. But this 401k at work, the Roth IRA at home, why shouldn't I do that too? And I would argue you should still do it, okay? Because those accounts offer two things that I think are very important. One is what's referred to as tax arbitrage, particularly the traditional 401k at work. So you're working today, you're probably paying on the last dollar you earn, you're paying 24%, maybe 32%. Okay, so that's a big tax bite on those last few dollars. Why not deduct the last $23,000, put into a 401k? Okay, well, you say, but that's going to be taxable later on and it's locked up till 59 and a half. Well, one, you are correct, it's taxable later on, but I highly doubt it's going to be subject to a 24% rate. It's probably going to be subject to a much lower rate. Two, it's not really locked up till we're 59 and a half, because what you could do is get to that early retirement, say 40, 41, 42, 43. You could say, oh, look, I have this old traditional 401k. It's got all this money in it, but it's locked up. Well, it doesn't have to be locked up for all that long. What you could do at age 40, 41, 42, and on is what they call a Roth conversion, right? This is a simple transaction, actually. All you're doing is you're saying, hey, I have a traditional IRA or 401k, something like that. I want to affirmatively move some amount of money from that traditional account to a Roth account, fully taxable. But if you're early retired, your income tax return is going to look like you're artificially poor. You don't generate a lot of income in that situation. You might generate some capital gains on, hey, I have some mutual funds, I sold them to fund my living expenses, but we'll talk about capital gains later. They tend to be very lightly taxed, and you're not taxed on the entire amount. You recover basis, so you're living on $100,000. I'm just using a round number, but you had, you know, $60,000 of basis. You're only taxed on, say, $40,000. You might be able to do a Roth conversion, a low bracket. You know, I think there's a real argument for both, right? This is not an either or. This is a shades of gray. If I was looking to retire in my early 40s and I'm in my late 20s, I want to be building up tax deferred accounts. I want to be thinking about things like the backdoor Roth, and I want to be building up taxable accounts.
Yeah, I'll be honest, Sean, you actually changed my opinion and strategy when I was prepping for this conversation. I was in the mindset, I don't know when I decided. Actually, I know when I decided this, probably 5 years ago, whenever I was in a much lower income bracket, and I probably was paying substantially less because I was making substantially less than I was now. And my thought was, I'm going to put everything into Roth, my IRA and my 401k, because my workplace lets me do that too, because I would rather just get the taxes done now and not really have to worry about it later on. And that's fair and fine. And I was like, you know what? My future self will thank me for this. Then I don't really even have to think about taxes. But you've been changing my mind slowly over the course of the last week or so, you know, as I was listening. And I was like, wow, I'm somebody that would take advantage of some of this tax arbitrage and be smart enough. And honestly, when we're looking at the profile, I'm probably going to be someone that you know, retires early or is financially independent sometime into their late 30s or early 40s. And I'm guessing I will still have many of years where I'm making income, maybe even substantial income, but there's probably many, many of years too that I might take many retirements or completely take a year off, and I might be coming up with a goose egg on my income. And those might be years where I could take advantage of some of this tax arbitrage that you're talking about. So just actually Monday, I went in and changed all of my 401k to a traditional. And I'm like, you know what? I'm building that baby back up, and I'm gonna let myself utilize some of this tax strategy later on in life.
Yeah, Justin. So, by the way, my thoughts in my own life have evolved on this question. You see a lot of commentators pushing Roth 401k, these traditionals are so bad. But they miss out on several points. And in fact, I don't know when this episode is going to air, a little behind the scenes for the listener. I've got a blog post coming out on April 30th that is basically saying, hey, you accumulators out there, the conventional wisdom's wrong. Because the conventional wisdom is saying, don't do these traditional 401ks, they're infested with taxes, you got to do Roth 401k. Well, it's missing several points. I'll give you two of them here. The first is this. When you access those traditional 401ks or IRAs in retirement, whether it's early retirement or conventional retirement, and whether it's just to take it the money out to live off of or to do these Roth conversions I was talking about, you go up the progressive tax brackets, right? You know, you say, well, I'm in the 24% bracket this year. I'm in the 32% bracket this year. Well, the income getting up there, though, is not taxed at 24 or 32. It's first taxed at 10% and then 12%, 22%. And so even in retirement, you know, even in a later retirement, you get to go back up those tax brackets. So if you're deducting today at work and you get a 24% on the 24 cents on the dollar, 32 cents on the dollar benefit for that deduction, that's great. Well, you know, in retirement, every year this will happen. It comes back into income maybe at 10% or 12%. Oh, by the way, before you collect Social Security, you might have that standard deduction, so it might actually come back into income at zero. All right, so that's one thing. The commentators just miss this issue, right? They talk about, oh, tax increases and taxes are so high. Yeah, but you got to go back through those low tax brackets. So that's one issue. The second issue for the potential early retiree in our audience is premium tax credits and Affordable Care Act, right? So you're going to retire at age 40. The odds are you're going to be on one of these Affordable Care Act medical insurance plans. Okay, that's fine, right? That's a different conversation, but you do need some financial protection in the event that you have significant illness or injury, right? Few are going to argue against that proposition, and ACA plans tend to be the way to go when we're not working and we're before age 65. Well, okay, how do I pay for that? Well, the premiums are actually pretty high. But there's something called a premium tax credit that says, well, if your income is relatively low, we're going to give you a very substantial tax credit against those premiums, and it's going to be financially a lot more viable. There's an interesting little twist to those rules, though, and the twist is this. Those rules tell us we have to have a relatively low but still substantial level of income. It depends on your state. It might be 100% of the federal poverty level that year, might be 138% of the federal poverty level that year, might be 150% of the federal poverty level that year. And, you know, I know in California for a family of four, it's over $40,000. If you don't hit that level, then based on the income rules, you technically, just under the income rules, I'm not saying in reality, but under the income rules, you qualify for the state's version of what they call Medicaid, so you don't get a premium tax credit. So, okay, let's play it out. You elect to have everything Roth. You get to early retirement. You got $2 million in a Roth account, $10,000 in a savings account, and a paid-off home, theoretically, right? You have no ability to generate taxable income, basically, at that point, other than going and getting a side hustle or something like that. So I want folks to be able to have at least some of these traditional retirement accounts, if only to be able to toggle on a little taxable income so that we just make sure we qualify for these premium tax credits if we're early retired. So anyway, so yeah, Justin, I mean, look, thoughts evolve. My own thoughts on this, when I was a younger guy, before I was a financial planner, and even early in my time as a financial planner, I was a lot more pro-Roth. These days, I say, look, Roth can be great. Roth conversions in early retirement, things like the so-called backdoor Roth, but it's not as great as people think, as some commentators say it is, during our accumulation years.
Yeah, I appreciate the nuance, and the premium tax credit was what really tipped me over the edge in that conversation, and just needing to have some kind of controllable income. But to kind of circle back to the initial line of thinking and walking through some of the steps too, I'm guessing one of the first places after your own income, as we mentioned, you know, you're probably gonna have part-time work or side hustles, real estate income, business income. Some of that's gotta help pay for life after FI. Or after maybe traditional corporate work, you know, let's just assume this person is now leaving their 9 to 5 and they're spending their time however they want to spend their time. Next up in that ladder of sequence is the taxable brokerage account, or at least I'm assuming the taxable brokerage account. And one of the reasons why this is probably the very first place to dip into is the opposite of controllable income, which is uncontrolled income. These things that spin off of the taxable brokerage account and actually make tax planning a little bit harder. And it might push you in certain directions. So it seems like maybe in your early years of FI, as you're drawing down on your retirement money, let it be retirement accounts or your taxable accounts, this is probably the place that you want to draw down on first. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I generally agree with that, Justin, for a number of reasons, right? One of them is this, like, let's go back to your example. Let's just say we're living off $60,000 a year. That's our, you know, $1.5 million is our FI number. So you say, oh, look, I have these brokerage accounts. They have mutual funds in them. I'm going to sell $60,000 worth of these mutual funds. And I'm going to trigger for tax purposes what's called a capital gain. Okay. So I have to look at, well, how much did I invest in those things over time? You know, whatever is more than what I invested is my so-called capital gain. That's my taxable income. So this is really neat. So you say, well, okay, I sold 60,000 mutual funds in my first year of early retirement. I had a $40,000 basis, say. Well, that means I only created taxable income of $20,000. So that's my initial, like, if I do nothing else, I have $20,000 of taxable income. How much federal income tax do I pay on that? Well, if that's your only income, the answer is zero. Well, how can that be? That's taxable income. Well, yes, it is. But if you can keep, basically the rule is, if you could keep your taxable income below the top of the 12% bracket, that's essentially the rule, you pay 0% federal income tax on those long-term capital gains. So that's really powerful because we're now paying 0% on $60,000 of proceeds, really $20,000 of gain in my example. And that's part of the reason I love going to these taxable assets first. We have no penalty on that. But then you say, well, oh, I only have $20,000 of taxable income. And I have a big standard deduction. Maybe what I could do is I could now do some Roth conversions, right? So I take my old traditional retirement account and I move it over to Roth. And that, you know, in today's rule numbers, 14,000, I think it's 600. I have to double check the number. But, you know, the first 14,600 under my example, if you had no other income other than that $20,000 capital gain, 0% income tax on that. And then even above that 14.6, we're at 10% and yada, yada. So it's very tax efficient, no penalty on that. And that does two things. One, it just moves that money into never taxed again accounts. That's great. Mm-hmm. But two, it also, whatever we convert today, 5 years down the road, we can access that tax and penalty free anytime, any reason. So worse, and sometimes this is referred to as a Roth conversion ladder. It can be very powerful for those getting to a super early retirement. Because what we do is we first live off the taxable assets, keep our taxable income low, and create these Roth conversion ladders where in 5 or more years, we can just withdraw those from our Roth accounts. So that can be very, very powerful. And that's just another reason to take the taxable assets first. No penalties, recovery of basis, you know, that's very powerful. And then the long-term capital gains rate, which can be very, very favorable.
Okay, let's back up and slow that down. And I want to make sure everyone's following along because I know we threw out a whole lot of numbers there too. So let's continue to use this profile. Let's call it, I need $60,000 to live in my kind of post-FI life. Maybe I'm making $10,000 off my side hustle that I have. So let's just bring it down to a round number of 50,000.
Okay.
You're now saying that I can pull out $50,000 from my taxable brokerage account. And I'm not actually paying taxes on that $50,000. I'm actually paying taxes on the delta of essentially how much I contributed to that taxable brokerage account, which is referred to as your basis. and what that taxable brokerage account has grown to. So maybe I have a $500,000 taxable brokerage account. I've contributed $250,000 into that brokerage account, you know, over the last 15 years. It's grown to $500,000. Essentially, my basis is 50%. So if I pull out $50,000 of that account, I pay taxes on $25,000 of that. You know, that's actually the real amount of money that was made on this transaction. And then there's some other funny nuance that this $25,000 isn't actually taxed like I'm used to it being taxed when I worked in a W-2 job and there's this progressive tax ladder. It actually moves into something else called capital gains, and that's treated in a completely different regard. You know, it's taxed at a different rate than the progressive tax system that you were mentioning there with the 10, 12, 22, 24. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Any details you can shore up there?
Well, yeah. So it's a combination of phenomenon. One is the one you just alluded to, where we're under the 12% bracket. So great. We're going to, you know, we essentially pay no federal income tax. That's pretty impressive. But then two, the other thing to keep in mind here is there's this odd phenomenon in U.S. tax called income stacking. And what it says is our ordinary income, so that $10,000 you were talking about, yourself, like you had a little self-employment, side hustle income, that $10,000 is the first that's taxed. Well, you as a single person have a $14,600 standard deduction. So all those 10 go at a 0% rate, right? And in fact, I mean, you know, I don't want to give anybody advice, but yeah. Our theoretical avatar here almost certainly should do at least $4,600 of Roth conversions just to soak up the rest of that standard deduction, because that would be a 0%. And then basically what would happen from there, that next $25,000, okay, great, that won't get to the top of the 12% bracket. So that $25,000 of capital gains you created will still qualify for the 0% income tax. So you would actually earn $10,000. You have to pay self-employment tax on this, but you don't pay income tax on it. Okay, so you get the $10,000 income tax free, you get, in my case, a $4,600 Roth conversion income tax free, and a $2,500 long-term capital gain income tax free. That's cooking with gas. The one little like fly in the ointment, check your state. In California, there'd be a little bit of tax on that. Most states would have a little bit of tax on that because they don't have that 0% long-term capital gains rate. I believe most states don't have that. So there'd be a little bit of state income tax, but you know, some of the states have these progressive, California, whatever you want to say about it, actually has progressive tax brackets too. So even in California, it wouldn't be that heavily taxed for state purposes. So yeah, you're cooking with gas if you're doing what you just talked about, Justin.
Yeah, and I think this is the real power, especially of the 20-somethings that are listening, that do have 15, 20, 25 years of runway to start building up income. And I really do think, you know, doing a lot of the right things, living below your means, investing the difference, you know, utilizing tax efficient and investment strategies and low cost index funds. I don't think it's that crazy to think that you might be retiring or at least hitting financial independence between 40 and 50, and therefore having, I don't know, maybe 15 to 20 years of creative tax planning like we're talking about right now, and really kind of getting the best of both worlds, not paying taxes now and potentially not paying some taxes in the future.
Yeah, and so Justin, I want to say something to this particular audience. You know, I know a lot of your listeners are in their mid to late 20s. Okay, so maybe they're on a social media platform I'm not on, TikTok. And maybe they're hearing, you know, Index Universal Life, it's so great, and it's tax-free income and retirement. Okay, well, why do you hear that, right? You hear that because they've got to give you an incentive. They got to scare you into making this decision in terms of buying like an IUL policy or something like that. So they have to have this boogeyman that taxes are so awful in retirement. And then you look at an example like you and I just went through, which is a theoretically possible example. It's certainly not your particular fact pattern, but you say, boy, those taxes don't look so bad in retirement. Then why would you use an IUL policy if that's their main point of contention? The other thing about the IUL is there's no deduction on the way in. So why would you, you know, essentially pass up on today's tax arbitrage, right? You know, in theory, if you're saying I'm going to work for 50 years and I'm going to be making $1 million a year, then the theory behind IUL actually makes a lot more sense. Tax-free income later in life, you're going to be paying so much tax the rest of your life. But if your plan is literally, I'm getting off the hamster wheel in my 40s or 50s, your plan is to be paying low tax for many years, starting once you get off the hamster wheel, then doesn't that tell us we should be taking as many deductions as possible today to get this tax rate arbitrage? So deduct, deduct, deduct today. But also, if you're, especially if you're thinking about retiring early, build up those taxable accounts. But as you're seeing, these taxable accounts tend to be relatively lightly taxed as well because of long-term capital gains, qualified dividend income tax rates. So yeah, I think, you know, when we think it through, we just want to be questioning some of the conventional wisdom and maybe some of the quote-unquote cutting-edge wisdom that's out there. Look, I'm not here to tell you to not buy an IUL or to buy an IUL, but I think the pitch sort of falls apart when we look at this particular profile of, wait a minute, I'm going to have years of artificially low taxable income if I do retire early. Why do I need to be avoiding all these taxes when my just my own plan basically has me avoiding a lot of these taxes?
Agreed. Man, I'm biting my tongue right now to not get on a tangent about IULs, but I'm very glad that you brought up that point. So let's come back to retirement accounts. You've already talked about Roth conversions. And once again, I want to put to bed a little bit of the scare of not being able to take any of the money out until 59 and a half of these 401ks and IRAs that you're funding today. There actually are, I would say, relatively simple ways to get money out of that account. Granted, maybe it's not what you want to pull out of first, like, you know, if you have a well-funded taxable brokerage account and it's spinning off uncontrolled income, okay, fine. Plus you got the tax-free growth that's happening and a lot of the retirement accounts too, so it makes sense to let that go. But let's say we burned through the taxable brokerage accounts, we're not really generating a ton of income, and we do need to start tapping into some of these actual tax-free or tax-deferred retirement accounts like the IRA or the 401k, let it be traditional or Roth. You brought up something interesting called the Roth conversion ladder. Can we go back through that one more time and also just talk about Roth contributions in general and the rules around those?
Yep. So Roths have this thing I refer to as Roth basis, which is essentially your accessible old annual contributions and your accessible old conversions. So your annual contributions, that's literally, I have a job, so I've earned income, and so I make an annual contribution to my Roth IRA. The current limit for those under 50 is $7,000 a year. Those annual contributions can be withdrawn at any time for any reason, tax and penalty free. So that creates Roth basis just when in our accumulation years. We have old annual contributions to Roth IRAs. That's great. But from there, you alluded to the Roth conversion ladder. What about these Roth conversions where it's not based on our annual income? It's just, hey, we have this old traditional retirement account. We move some over affirmatively. We even pay tax on that. Well, when can I get that money? Well, it's not any time for any reason tax and penalty free. It's generally after 5 years. So if you get into early retirement, yeah, you can, on the day you early retire, you have all your old annual contributions, you can access tax and penalty free. But why not start building up these five-year-old conversions? So in the first year of early retirement, you do a Roth conversion. In year six, you know, add five. In year six, you can access that tax and penalty free anytime, any reason, and then keep going. Year two, year seven, year three, year eight. And maybe you don't have to access them until year eight or year nine. So you have all the old annual contributions and you have 3 or 4 or 5 years of old five-year-old Roth conversions. Great, right? All those things together, Roth and old annual contributions and our five-year-old taxable Roth conversions are, generally speaking, our Roth basis that we can access today. So that can be very powerful and that can help fund later parts of your retirement. Now you say, or later parts of your quote unquote early retirement. Now you say, well, wait a minute, John, I thought we needed taxable income. And yeah, if you're on an ACA plan, you probably still do. And if I'm just taking Roth basis, there's no taxable income. Well, do more Roth conversions. Hopefully you still have a bunch in that traditional retirement account. Just keep doing those Roth conversions while you're drawing down Roth basis, right?
Yeah.
And then those will become 5 years old in 5 years, but they'll also create the small amount of income you might need to qualify for the premium tax credit.
That's so interesting. You can just put this nice cycle or system together and really just fund a lifestyle, I think, and help bridge the gap between 40 and 59 and a half And I think it's a fairly simple and straightforward way to go about it. And just to reiterate here, so you're telling me, so this year I contributed $7,000 to my IRA. Last year, I don't know, $6,500 the year before that, $6,000 the year before that, $55,000 or whatever. I add up all of the contributions I've made over the last 10 years. I can access that money today, essentially. I can pull that out of my Roth IRA.
Yeah, well, and just to be precise, it's got to be those contributions to a Roth IRA. So if it's to a traditional IRA, that doesn't work. But if it's 10 years to any Roth IRA, and you know, people get hung up on like, oh, I have this Roth IRA at one institution, and at the separate institution, I have a second Roth IRA. For these purposes, what the rules tell us is they're all smushed together. It's called aggregation. So if you have 10 Roth IRAs, the tax laws say, no, you actually have one Roth IRA, right? That's just what the tax law says. It turns out to be taxpayer favorable, right? So you don't have to say, well, I only made one annual contribution to this particular Roth IRA. I can only access that from that Roth IRA. No, they're aggregated. And so that actually works out very favorably for taxpayers.
Administratively, how does it work? Do you have to notify the Fidelities of the world that I'm pulling out my contributions?
Or so it's,
how does that mechanically work?
That is
work?
Such a great question, Justin. And so here's the thing. You could say whatever you want to say about Fidelity, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise, right? I'm not here to comment on Fidelity. Here's one thing I can tell you about Fidelity. They don't know the totality of your tax situation because they don't know the years that you went into Vanguard and made a Roth IRA contribution over there, or Schwab, or T. Rowe Price, or whatever your institution is. So all they can tell you, and what they're going to do, is they're going to issue you, if you take, you're under 59.5, they're going to issue you in January as a form called a 1099-R. They're going to issue it to you and to the IRS. And so that's a fancy way of saying, boy, when you file that tax return, the gross distribution better be reported or the IRS computer is not going to be happy with you. But it's no big deal. What you then have to do is you have to put that on your tax return. There's actually a form. It's an 8606 Part 3. It's the second page of this form, 8606. You can Google it. It'll come up as a PDF. What you have to do is make sure that form shows, hey, I took a distribution from a Roth IRA this year, whatever the amount is. And then you have to say, well, what's my previous contributions, 5-year-old conversions? Basically, it's going to ask for your previous contributions and conversions. And as long as that amount is greater than the amount you took as a distribution, you're going to be fine. You know, the contributions, 5-year-old conversions. And so then it'll go on that 8606 Part 3. It'll actually go on page one of the tax return as a quote-unquote gross distribution, and then the taxable amount will be zero. There's two boxes on that page one. You just say, it's a gross distribution, but the taxable amount is zero, and you go on from there. So the one thing I would say, too, is, you can go through your old institution records and document. I just keep a little spreadsheet. Oh yeah, I have these 10 years of old contributions, so that's however much that is. I have so many. I keep a little spreadsheet, Google Sheet, Microsoft Excel. It doesn't have to be all that complicated, but just through your old records, your own knowledge. Oh yeah, I did a $20,000 conversion that year. I did a $6,000 contribution that year. Just sort of have a bit of a record to help prove that up.
Yeah. I think that's a good thing to start if you haven't already implemented. And of course, maybe go back and find that in the past, knowing that you're probably going to need that number eventually.
Well, you do if you plan on taking money from a Roth IRA prior to age 59.5. Once you get to 59.5 and you've had any Roth IRA in the world for 5 years, that number is now entirely academic. Everything you take out is just a qualified distribution, totally tax and penalty free. And you can throw away that spreadsheet unless you just want to have it for historical reference, But other than that, you don't need it.
I would be someone that would keep that for historical reference just because that's who I am. So there are a couple of other nuance or options that are out there. I don't think we need to double click or explore all of these in totality. A couple of things that I learned through researching you. One is not 401k, but if you're on a 457B, you can actually pull out of this account penalty-free. There is no penalty, correct?
For a governmental 457B, they just don't apply the 10% early withdrawal penalty. I actually haven't gone back and researched why the heck that is. Is that was that a giveaway to government workers? Was that just an accident in terms of how they wrote the legislation? But yeah, so you can work for governmental 457, or typically these are like governmental employees, have some government connection. They have a 457B. It works very similar to a 401k, and you defer, you know, you take a tax deduction, $23,000, you know, and then great. You could retire at 40, 50, whatever it is. There's just no early withdrawal penalty. It'll be subject to tax, you know, or you do the Roth conversions. I would still say that person probably still wants to spend down the taxable assets first in most cases, right? Not giving you advice, but academically, that seems to make sense. And maybe does Roth conversions out of that. The one issue, so, you know, we think about, well, big picture planning, and then how do we implement that? You can't roll that to a traditional IRA and still get the 10% early withdrawal penalty exception. So if you're like, oh, you know, I'm going to retire early, go through your plan documents. There should be something called a summary plan description. You just want to make sure it's going to be easy to access that money in terms of partial distributions. You don't have to, you know, they can have different rules on their distributions. So you just want to double check that. But the 457 can be a great way. You got to keep it in there till 59 and a half to qualify to make sure you get the exception. But that can be a great workaround for certain people at certain employers to access that money before 59 and a half.
That's awesome. Let's keep punching a couple more here. There are also certain exceptions for 401ks, IRAs that you can pull money out. Most of them seem like emergency situations. Can you highlight a couple of those?
Yeah, there are some emergency situations. And you got to remember too, when we're taking out money from a 401k, it may be that we have a hardship situation that qualifies as an emergency so that we can get the money out of the account, but it may not qualify for the 10% early withdrawal penalty. So you got to do a little diligence there. There are times where we have significant medical expenses and we can use distributions. I believe that's only from an IRA. The IRS has a great, Justin, if you don't mind, I can send you, the IRS has a great website and I could send that for the show notes that goes through the different penalty exceptions. You know, so there are exceptions where, hey, we're having some sort of hardship. I mean, now with Secure 2.0, there's some exceptions for sort of some different things like domestic abuse survivors, certain federally declared disaster areas. There's an exception there. Once a year, $1,000, I refer to as the minor emergency withdrawal exception, where you just take $1,000 and they're not, you know, they're not going to impose the penalty if you have some sort of emergency. So there are these little exceptions out there. You generally don't want to go into retirement like relying on one of these emergency exceptions, but they are there. It's one of those things where that's this IRS website I'm referencing. If you ever find, hey, I took the money out and I, you know, you should always at least reference this website and say, hey, is there a chance I could, you know, avoid this 10% penalty? It's at least worth asking. Certain tuition can qualify for that. So that could be a thing if you got like a kid with some tuition. Oh, we pay these tuition bills this year. Maybe we can get around the 10% penalty that way.
I think that makes sense. And one more that I want to call out here around the HSA, you call it HSA P-U-Q-M-E.
Yeah, let's talk about this, right? So I do not mean to be saying an expletive here. It sounds like an expletive, but it's not. I refer to this as PUCME, P-U-Q-M-E, previously unreimbursed qualified medical expenses. So the idea here, and this is actually really good for young folks. So, you know, this combines a high deductible health plan at work, HSA, health savings account. I like this for a number of reasons. One, hopefully if we're young and healthy, we don't need to be big users of medical care. So why not have a higher deductible, lower the premium that we pay? And so we're saving first dollar because we're paying less in insurance premiums. When you have this high deductible plan, you can get a so-called HSA. Once you have that HSA in place, a good exercise is to track your medical expenses and pay them out of your pocketbook. Put them on the credit card, checkbook. Do not pay them from the HSA. What you can do later on in life is reimburse yourself tax and penalty free for previously unreimbursed qualified medical expenses. There's no time limit on it. So you could be 29 years old, you sprain an ankle playing flag football, you know, over the weekend, you have a $500 medical bill, you know, say, you know, put it in a Google sheet, save a receipt, and guess what? You know, years down the road, you can reimburse yourself tax and penalty free. So this could be something in an early or even conventional retirement to do. Basically, reimburse yourself for that, what I call PUCME, and it's a tax and penalty free bailout of that HSA money. It can be a really nice thing. And you know, if you have that HSA for the first time in your, you know, late 20s, you could have years of medical expenses, even if you're relatively healthy. The annual exam, you know, the annual physical or whatever it is, it can absolutely work very powerfully to build up money tax and penalty free for a long time and then withdraw it later in life. And it could be in an early retirement.
Yeah, and I think there's another IRS website for this too, but there's a whole laundry list of things that are essentially HSA qualified. And some sites also give that reference. I know Amazon has like a logo if it's HSA qualified for some things, and feminine products and other kind of Band-Aids and random things like that are also qualified. So if you're pretty good at keeping records, you might be able to stack up some of this over a 10, 20, 50-year time span.
Yes, and Justin, Dr. Google every now and then can be very helpful. So I would recommend folks Google, it's called IRS Publication 502. It's all about the medical and dental expenses. And it's about making sure you have a qualified medical expense. And if you do, you now have Puck Me. I will say too to the audience, right? So different people are different ways about keeping records. I myself, you know, my wife and I are a little different on this. I don't like, hey, we bought some Band-Aids. Let's put a $5 entry into a spreadsheet, right? That's not my game. But some people, it is their game. So I would just say, look, track the really, you know, the big medical expenses. And look, if you, you know, maybe you like tracking expenses and the $5 isn't such a big deal. I just sort of say, well, $5, do I really care about that? But
I'm probably with you on that one a little bit. That was more so a call out too of like, if there's something routine or ongoing that you're always purchasing, maybe that's worth considering.
Yep.
There are a few other ones out there. If we haven't already given you a ton of other options and help burden the ease of realizing that you can pull some of this money out of your retirement accounts, two other very popular ones that there's tons of other podcast episodes on, the Rule 55 and 72T. Actually, Sean did a really amazing job breaking down 72T on the Choose FI episode, I think it was 475. So if you want to learn a little bit more about that, I think those, go check out that episode. I feel like those are maybe a little bit later stage than the profile we're talking about right now. They become a little bit more complex whenever you're looking at, you know, utilizing some of those at the age of 40 versus, you know, later on. I mean, the Rule 55, you got to be over 55. So let's call that one.
So 72T, you could be reasonably maybe as early as the late 40s, certainly in your 50s. Rule 55, you got to be at least turning 55 in the year you separate from service. So that's when going to be a lot more limited if we're thinking about age 40. Even a 72T at age 40s, it's not really going to be that practical, but you never know. But anyway, yeah, I think we've covered the big ones. I'd say, especially for the you know, if the super early retiree, it's going to be the taxable accounts and the Roth basis are going to be the two big ones to be thinking about. And the cool thing is using the taxable accounts first facilitates building up more and more Roth basis. So they sort of work in a good harmony.
Yeah. And if you really get down to it and you got to pay the 10% penalty, well, you probably did something right in life too. So Sean, this was a pleasure. Thanks for sticking around for a little bit longer too. I know we had some technical difficulties there at the beginning, but I'd love for you to call out where people can find more of you. You got an awesome YouTube page and also a blog that's out there.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Justin. Really appreciate it. You can find my YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube. It's Sean Mullaney Videos. So just put Sean Mullaney Videos in the search bar. And then my blog is FITaxGuy.com. It's the intersection of tax planning and financial independence.
Cool. Sean, let's bring it home. I think you've gotten this question before, but I actually can't remember because you were on episode 39 and 40. So way back in the archive and actually talking about HSAs, episode 40 is all about HSAs. So if you want to learn a ton about that, Sean did a great job breaking down HSAs for us on that episode. So it might be a good follow-up if you're looking for another podcast to listen to right now. But I want to ask you my final question. If you had the opportunity to teach a 16-week class to a group of graduating college seniors on a topic that isn't normally covered in the classroom, what would you teach and how would you teach it?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. That is a very tough one, Justin. I will say I struggle with this question, but I will say, you know, personal finance is not normally taught. And so I think I would teach a 16-week class on the various retirement accounts and the pros and cons of each. One thing I think, there's too much fear out there about, oh, these traditional retirement accounts are full of tax. Well, if you actually start breaking down numbers, you find out they're usually not all that full of tax in most situations. So I think I do a lot of examples, right? It's nice. It's not about knowing every last rule of the tax code. It's about, well, okay, from a planning perspective, what does this look like at the end, even if we are very successful? And I think what most people would find is, okay, these traditional retirement accounts, not that we can't do some Roths, but these traditional retirement accounts tend to be pretty efficient when we're trying to save for retirement.
Yeah, and just even zooming out a little further than that, and just the basics on investing, you know, breaking down retirement accounts, but just how to actually go about investing. I know myself and many of my other friends too, is just, it's so convoluted and so scary whenever you're taking your first initial steps into investing. And then you kind of do it and you realize, well, was that it? Is that all? Like now what do I do? Just keep doing the same thing over and over again? And you know, it's kind of a yes to that. So Sean, I'd really enjoy that class and it'd be great to be a student in that one. So once again, everyone, this is Sean Mullaney, FI Tax Guy. Go check him out on his blog or on YouTube, Sean Mullaney Video. Sean, man, thanks again for coming on The Struggle Is Real.
Justin, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the episode. As always, I appreciate your kind words. If you want to leave us a rating and review on your podcast player right now, that would absolutely make my day. If you want to find episode show notes, our blog, and other great resources, head over to tsirpodcast.com. If you have follow-up questions, an idea for a future episode, or just want to say hi, we have a contact form on our website, and those messages go straight into my inbox, and I promise you, I will reply. But all right, guys, I really appreciate you tuning in. I love you all, and you're not alone. Let's keep making it through our struggles together.